thou art a ghost that hath come from the earth, or a phantom of night that hath no heart, or one that lieth dead in the desert, or a ghost unburied, or a demon, or a ghoul. Whatever thou be, until thou art removed, thou shalt find here no water to drink. Thou shalt not stretch forth thy hand to our own. Into our house enter thou not. Through our fence break through thou not. We are protected, though we may be frightened. Our life you may not steal, though we may be scared to death.
Welcome to Scared to Death, Creeps, Peepers, Roberts, and Annabelles.
That's nice.
What if I tried to talk like that the whole episode?
Could you do that? Or would your
it would hurt my throat after
cords,
a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially if I wasn't drinking water. I have to like do a little bit, drink water, do a little bit.
It'd be super fun for editing. A lot of stops.
Thank you so much for the many fantastic ratings and reviews lately,
thank you.
For the Scared to Death shows that we continue to do and for the Nightmare Fuel episodes. It's so very good. Encouraging. So thank you.
Yay.
And now just going to jump into it.
Let's go.
What fan submitted horror do you have this week?
Okay. So my first tale is like, get the tissues ready. It is a tearjerker. It is a beautiful story and a wonderful confirmation tale. And then my second story is actually from one person, but for many stories about his experiences working at a prison.
Cool.
Yeah, I really liked it.
All right. I look forward to hearing both of those.
Good. I hope you are.
I have my two, my normal two. I have a story from Buffalo, New York, and then another from Guadalajara, Mexico.
My uncle died in Buffalo, New York.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
There you go.
And the first story, we'll look into the beautiful Richardson Hotel.
No, he didn't. He died in Syracuse.
Oh, okay.
You're welcome.
The Richardson Hotel, it really is like a gorgeous hotel. And it was once the Buffalo State Asylum for the insane. I will say just really quick randomly about Buffalo after having, you know, been there a few times.
Yeah.
The architecture in Buffalo is incredible.
It's so random because you don't expect it.
And I don't even know why I didn't expect it, you know, like there, but it is.
Because you just think, you're thinking like, oh, I think this is what happens with much of New York. If you're not in the city and you're not like the Hamptons or some like, you know, like Ithaca kind of
I think more industrial.
Exactly. You just think, well, it's just probably like some other.
Kind of like Rust Belt.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Middle of nowhere. Nothing that exciting going on. Buffalo.
Oh, it is. The most like if you stunning. Are like desiring like for not a lot of money you know like you're on a budget but you really want to live in like a classic Victorian house or something, it's an amazing city.
And
the architecture is off the charts
and just like a good solid working class kind of people,
good vibes there.
They're really into their sports team. Well, you know, it reminds me so much of Cleveland, like the suburbs,
and Cleveland has a lot of cool buildings.
Cleveland's pretty amazing.
So yeah, so interesting history with this story, plus a really creepy modern encounter story. And then we'll head to Guadalajara, Mexico, and explore a bunch of paranormal legends and claims of sites, all revolving around the Santa Paula Cemetery.
Okay. I'm just singing Buffalo Soldier in my head.
Okay. All right, Marley, you socked up, ready to begin?
I am socked. I picked these ones, these Freddy Krueger socks.
Oh, nice. I like those.
Because they... And yes, we are wearing the same clothes we were wearing last week. We're doing back-to-back recordings. Let's go.
All right. We've covered a lot of haunted places here at Scared to Death, but maybe none quite like this one. We visited homes plagued by poltergeists, national parks where hikers have been maimed, murdered, and kidnapped. We've traveled to faraway lands where urban legends of malevolent entities seem to be something more than a mere bedtime story told to scare children. And we've checked into hotels where suicides have led to rooms being haunted for decades, bones being found inside walls, and living guests tormented by the dead who never checked out. We've explored quite literally hundreds of places where the reports of the unworldly are too voluminous to discount. But in terms of sheer history of the supernatural, few rival the legacy, if you will, of the Richardson Hotel in Buffalo, New York. The Richardson Hotel sits imposingly on 42 acres of sprawling land opposite Buffalo State University. Although it looks as though it was built in the 12th century with its massive verdigris towers and squat arches spanning a foreboding entrance, the structure was actually first erected in 1873. Compared to the medieval fortresses and castles it resembles, the Richardson Hotel has a relatively short history. However, in just 151 years, the property has stood witness to an immeasurable amount of suffering and sorrow, and subsequently become known as one of the most haunted places in America. And in addition to garnering a terrifying reputation in just a century and a half, the Romanesque Revival building has also accomplished something few other haunted places have. Since 2013, even if they've never been to New York, even if they've never left their house to do it, millions of people have unwittingly visited the Richardson Hotel, at least virtually. They've just known it as Mount Massive Asylum. In 2013, the first-person survival horror video game, Outlast, was released on Microsoft Windows, Xbox One, PlayStation 4. By 2018, it had sold over 15 million copies worldwide.
Oh.
And in the game, players step into the life of journalist Miles Upshur, who has traveled to the privately owned Mount Massive Asylum in Leadville, Colorado, to investigate reports of illegal human experimentation. There, he finds the asylum overrun with danger or deranged cannibalistic patients whose minds and bodies have been mutilated, as well as phantasmic wraiths slaughtering both escaped patients and hospital workers alike. The morbid game, actually pretty bummed, I've never played it after looking into it, was a massive global success. Fans were particularly enraptured by the macabre and repulsive setting they were transported into, a setting that few knew was modeled after a very real place, the Richardson Hotel. In 1871, construction began on what would become the Richardson Hotel on 203 acres of farmland. The property took 9 years to complete and was designed by famed architect Henry Hobson Richardson, who is seen by many as an equal to Frank Lloyd Wright. The building finally opened in 1880 as the Buffalo State Asylum for the Insane. According to an article from the Buffalo Weekly Courier, published in 1872, prior to the establishment of the new facility, a large portion of the insane from this region of the state were sent to the New York State Lunatic Asylum located at Utica, but that hospital could not, with justice to the patients, accommodate all those applying for admission and treatment. It was therefore wisely determined by the state that other asylums should be erected to meet the pressing and increasing wants of this unfortunate class. The complex served as an insane asylum for almost 100 years, and in 1973, it was added to the National Register of Historic Places. Less than a year later, it was shut down completely, and the last of its patients were moved out, or so the building's owners thought. The abandoned asylum sat as an empty hallmark of history gone by all the way until 2017, when it was reopened briefly as Hotel Henry. Due to the tourism drought brought on by the pandemic, in 2021, the four-year-old hotel closed its doors. However, those doors were promptly reopened just recently, in September of 2023, by real estate developer Douglas Jamal, and it was renamed the Richardson Hotel. Though the Richardson Hotel is comprised of four floors, 88 rooms, an Italian restaurant, a bar, cafe, and lounge, and ballroom, it only occupies approximately a third of what used to be the insane asylum facility, which currently leaves the majority of the former asylum grounds uninhabited, at least by the living. The operational spaces of the hotel have been subtly sectioned off from the uninhabited spaces, and the latter is inaccessible to everyone except staff. However, given the layout of the property, there are a few hotel rooms with a direct view of the abandoned portion, and many hotel guests have claimed that from this vantage point, they have witnessed flashes of the paranormal entities that may reside on the other side. Since it was reopened to the public, people from all across America have flocked to the Richardson Hotel to experience one of the most haunted places in America for themselves. Visitors have reported hearing the phantom sound of shuffling footsteps outside their hotel bedrooms and agonizing screams echoing down the broad halls. It seems that, much like the asylum was abandoned by the living and preserved in a perpetual state of decadent decay, the souls of patients that used to walk its extra-wide corridors have been left there to rot, suspended in a prison of timeless nothingness. According to reports, some of these spirits appear to be under the impression that they are still alive and undergoing treatment at the insane asylum, convinced that the monotony they're experiencing in death is just an extension of the repetitive routine they were submitted to in life. Others, however, don't seem so easily fooled. More than passive spirits that do nothing but sit and stare, hotel guests report seeing or experiencing entities that are practically pulsing with hatred. It's believed that these malevolent spirits delight in inflicting the abuse they experienced at the Buffalo State Asylum for the Insane on those who now vacation at the Richardson Hotel. An alarming number of people have reported being woken up by the petrifying feeling of being restrained at the ankles and wrists as they lay in their hotel bed, or being overcome with the strange feeling of being confined inside their accommodations, convinced that if they tried to open their hotel room door, they would find it locked from the outside. Another odd phenomenon that seems to occur frequently at the Richardson Hotel is unbearably freezing water. In the hotel bathrooms, the new state-of-the-art showers will suddenly become ice cold, the water assaulting guests instead of cleaning them. Although irregular water pressure and temperature seems like a fairly mundane problem for a new hotel to have, it's easy to think, in light of the building's history and other paranormal activity, to have a more sinister origin when you remember the hydrotherapy that was a common practice at psychiatric hospitals during the early and middle 19th century, including it's a Buffalo State Asylum for the Insane. Hydrotherapy was a form of treatment where patients were exposed to very hot or very cold water in a bathtub. Or after modern plumbing became more accessible, a shower for an extended period of time, sometimes minutes, sometimes hours and hours and hours. The practice was initially used to calm patients down as it was believed that the extreme temperatures helped eliminate supposed toxins, thought for a time to cause insanity. However, eventually, hydrotherapy largely began to be used as a form of control and/or punishment, instead of as a form of comfort and therapy. And subjecting patients to ice-cold showers or boiling hot baths became an all-too-common method of outright abuse. Although there has been a sharp increase in ghost sightings since the Richardson Hotel opened up a year ago, the peak of paranormal activity at the New York property actually occurred during the 1970s and 1980s, shortly after it was deinstitutionalized and closed off from the world of the living. The following claim comes from a woman who reports having been confronted by a ghost in one of the long-forgotten patients of the asylum while attending college at the nearby university. Time now for the tale of Naked, Cold, and Afraid. Maxine was a freshman at Buffalo State University in 1983. She had moved to the frigid state of New York from the only slightly less frigid state of Colorado with hopes of shedding the shackles of her high school persona, reinventing herself, and meeting new and interesting friends. Upon arriving at the university in the fall, Maxine thought that the best way to accomplish both goals was to join a sorority. In high school, she'd been a bit of a floater. She was generally liked or at least felt neutral about by her classmates and could easily fit into most of the cliques that divided most of the rest of the school. She was, in essence, a chameleon that way. And she was tired of that. By joining a sorority, not only would she be an undeniable, indispensable official member of a group of friends, she would also be made special by it. Being part of something special would make her special, or at least, that's what she believed. Determined to become a sister of one kind or another, Maxine underwent the whole grueling process of rush week and bid day. She was interviewed by what felt like 1,000 intimidating pretty girls and recited some version of the words, "Well, all I really want is to be part of a sisterhood and make a difference in my community," more times than she could count. And in the end, it was worth it. She was accepted into a sorority. She doesn't actually name which one, so we'll say the sorority Maxine was accepted into was Beta Theta Pi. She was overjoyed. Images of formal dances and house parties and forever friendships flooded her mind. She knew in her bones that being part of a sisterhood was the perfect way to start the next 4 years of her life. But as Maxine would soon find out, just because she had received a bid from Beta Theta Pi, that didn't mean she was a sister. To be bestowed that great honor, she would have to earn her place. 2 weeks after getting her letter of acceptance, Maxine stood shivering in a parking lot on the south side of campus. She was joined by 4 other pledges, all of them equally freezing. Each girl had been told to meet in the parking lot at midnight and to dress like it was spring break in Miami. But it wasn't spring break in Miami. It was October in New York. And soon it was 12:30. "When are they going to be here?" one pledge asked. Maxine didn't bother answering. When she'd arrived 40 minutes earlier, the same girl asked Maxine if she thought they were actually going to be taken on a red-eye flight to Miami for the weekend. Maxine, quiet and polite as she appeared, had very little patience for stupidity. Finally, a truck pulled up and 2 slightly older girls popped out. The one Maxine thought was named Amanda approached the pledges with a massive smile. She was wearing a puffer jacket, leg warmers, and a pair of pink earmuffs. "Ladies, as you know, my name is Amanda, and I'm the vice president of Sisterhood Engagement and Party Planning. Thank you for coming. You all look adorable." She paused for a moment to allow the pledges to thank her enthusiastically. "Tonight," she said, "you'll partake in a Beta Theta Pi tradition that is almost 4 decades old. You all know about the Buffalo State Asylum for the Insane?" she said, gesturing to the distant red building behind the girls. They all nodded. Maxine nodded along but had no real idea what they were talking about. She'd never really given the property next to campus any thought. Amanda continued, "Well, tonight, we're going to drive you to the edge of the old insane asylum. Once we park, you are going to get out and climb over the fence. Then when we say go, you're going to run a little relay for us. Each of you will run from the fence across the lawn to the front door of the insane asylum and back. When you get back, you'll touch the next girl's hand, and then they can go. The order of the relay will be the order that you were chosen by Beta Theta Pi. So first choice is first runner, second choice is second runner, third choice is third runner, fourth choice is fourth runner." And Amanda shifted her gaze so she was making direct eye contact with Maxine. "Last choice is last runner. Any questions?" The girls were silent. Maxine's gut was in knots, almost like it was screaming in protest. No part of her had any interest in trespassing on private property, let alone property that used to be home to a bunch of insane people. But her voice of reason was drowned out by another voice, one that told her that this was her one chance. It was something she had to do. If she wanted any shot of having a social life at all in college, she needed to do this. She needed to prove that she wasn't a wimp. She needed to prove that she would do anything for her sisters. When no one spoke up, Amanda clapped her hands together and exclaimed, "Amazing! Let's head over then, shall we?" While making her way casually to the truck with the pledges in tow, Amanda suddenly whipped around. The other girls jolted to a stop. "I forgot to mention one more thing. You'll be running naked. Sound good?" This time, she didn't wait for an answer. She just smiled mischievously, swung back around, and climbed into the passenger seat while the pledges crammed into the bed of the truck. A few minutes later, Maxine and the other pledges had successfully maneuvered their way over the chain link fence of the abandoned property and were preparing for their relay. "Strip!" one of the older girls in the cab of the truck yelled, and they obeyed. Trying not to think about the anxiety boiling within her and focusing instead on what a great story this would be one day, Maxine began removing her cutoff shorts and tank top, her bra and underwear next. She then promptly covered her private bits with her freezing hands and awaited further instruction. Maxine scanned her surroundings. In the distance, the abandoned asylum didn't look all that scary. In the dark and through a bit of fog, she could make out its two tall towers and the general shape of the thing. And in its vague, shapeless form, the asylum seemed a lot less threatening than she'd expected. Maxine's thoughts were interrupted by Amanda's high-pitched voice coming from behind her. "No shoes either, ladies! Take them off!" Once all the pledges were laid totally bare and vulnerable, she spoke again from the comfort of the warm truck. "All right, ladies. Jessica, you'll be going first. Rachel, you're second. Catherine, third. Michelle, fourth. And Maxine, you're going last. Everyone got it? Great. Get ready, Jessica. On your mark. Get set. Go!" Jessica took off in a dead sprint towards the abandoned insane asylum until she was nothing but a silhouette. Maxine shook out her hands, trying to get some blood flowing to her digits. They were on the edge of starting to go numb. She'd been a little embarrassed at first about being naked, but eventually the shame faded and all she felt was cold. Cold and scared. The rush of enthusiasm that had propelled her over the fence in the first place had dissipated. One by one, each girl leapt into action and bolted towards the deserted building cloaked in shadows, and came back, gasping for breath, clammy and laughing. Eventually, it was Maxine's turn. As Michelle came into view, barreling toward her like a predator to its prey, Maxine tried to remember why she was doing this. In a split second, Michelle slapped her open hand and Maxine launched out into a full sprint. The dead grass was wet and sharp under her feet, and Maxine wondered if in other years they made pledges do this even if there was snow or ice on the ground. Before she knew it, Maxine had almost reached the building and had to start veering to the right to find the entrance. It had happened so fast. What had she even been worried about? This was no big deal. She was almost done. As she rounded the corner and saw the main entrance, Maxine felt almost giddy with pride and excitement and picked up her stride, and then it all came crashing down. Her ankle buckled and rolled, and Maxine collapsed, face forward into the hard ground. For a moment, she just laid there, cheek flattened against the hard dirt, mouth flooding with a metallic taste of a bit of blood. Tears started to well in her eyes, out of fear of what this meant for her future as a sorority sister, more than out of pain. As Maxine began adjusting to see if she could stand, she heard something. Footsteps. At first, she thought it was one of the other girls coming to check on her. "Hello?" she said to the dark. The dark did not respond. Then something else captured her attention. Bright headlights in the distance, driving steadily towards where Amanda had parked. She immediately thought, "Oh, shit." From the ground, she watched with growing horror as the car drew closer to the other girls, wondering what they would do in response to the imminent threat. Would they all scatter around the grounds of the abandoned insane asylum? Would they hide in the truck? Would they wait for it to pass and then come help her? Would they flee and abandon her? Her questions were answered by the sound of a car engine rumbling to life. Craning her neck, she watched Amanda's truck speed down the street and disappear onto the main road. They fled. They did leave her. They left her literally naked and afraid, and at an abandoned insane asylum in the middle of the night. Panic more visceral than anything Maxine had ever experienced consumed her. Everything now felt horribly wrong. Her exposed skin felt brittle and numb. Her ankle ached and throbbed. Frozen dirt was embedded on her cheeks and stomach and legs, and a swollen helplessness as heavy as cement kept her paralyzed on the ground. Less out of courage and more out of desperation, she peeled herself off the dead grass and cold dirt and surveyed the area. at a complete loss for what to do next. Though she thought she was completely alone, she still covered her private bits with her hands, in fear of what may lurk in the shadows. Then, in the empty darkness, she heard it again. Footsteps. Dull, quiet footsteps. Slowly, she turned to face the source of the sound. From the entrance of the abandoned asylum, the indistinct figure of a woman was approaching Maxine. She appeared to be wearing a cloak wrapped around her head and shoulders. Besides that, it was difficult to make out any of her specific features. Like the insane asylum itself from a distance, the woman looked shapeless and vague. But then, to Maxine's abject horror, though the woman was getting closer and closer by the second, she remained blurry and indistinct. Maxine was dumbstruck by what had to be an optical illusion. Her mind couldn't comprehend what else it could be. The woman was much closer now, but still just as hazy, like her image hadn't fully rendered yet. Maxine began to back up, unable to take her eyes off the inexplicable figure. Almost as if in response to Maxine's subtle movements, the figure began to run. Maxine screamed. Instinct took over and forced her legs into a sprint, the ground thumping flatly beneath her bare and by now bleeding feet, her whole body aching from the cold. She felt exhausted and powerless, but had no choice but to keep going. God knows what the formless entity would do if it caught up. With all her might and willpower, Maxine ran towards the spot by the fence where she had left her clothes and hoped to God they would still be there. And by the grace of God, or the grace of Amanda from Beta Theta Pi, they were. Without looking back, she grabbed her clothes, frantically climbed over the chain-link fence. Only when she was firmly on the other side of the Buffalo State Asylum's property did she turn around, and the woman was gone. In that moment, there was a small part of Maxine that wanted to stick around and see if she could see where she went. But the smarter part of her brain, the same part that had objected to the whole relay idea in the first place, insisted she throw her clothes on and run the rest of the way home to campus, which is exactly what she did. In the end, Maxine never did join the sorority. She backed out. She decided the whole thing was bullshit and that she could find lifelong friendships and a sense of identity on her own. She never told anyone about the spectral woman either. For a long time, she doubted that she saw anything at all. The whole thing had such a distinct and befuddling sense of unreality to it. As the years passed, she probably would have eventually come to the conclusion that the woman had just been a figment of her imagination, produced in a moment of extreme fear and anxiety, if it hadn't been for the headaches. From that fateful night during the fall of her freshman year until she left New York in 1987, every time she drove past the decaying remains of the Buffalo State Asylum, Maxine was assailed by the feeling of an unbearable, excruciating pain throbbing behind her right eye socket and splitting her head in two. And then the pain would leave as quickly as it had arrived, disappearing once she'd finished driving past. She also felt a brief but powerful urge to enter the building as she drove by, to find the woman she'd seen that night, the woman who wanted to share something with her, and finally know what would happen if she didn't run away.
Dang. Hazing is so fucked up.
I know. I think it's, from what I've heard, it's much, much more tampered down in recent years than it used to be.
Yeah, because people are dying.
Horror stories. Yeah, people dying, people being, I mean, essentially just sexually assaulted under the guise of a prank. Ugh. Just like crazy stories.
People are insane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All for what?
I know, it is this funny thing where it's like people, like in a situation like that, will have something sadistic and needless done to them and hate it. And then like the next year, it's kind of like the Stanford prison experiment. Now they're the guard.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, they want to be sadistic to somebody else and punish them. It's just like, it's a weird part of human nature.
Ugh.
I have some photos.
Okay.
Okay, this first one's a photo of the Buffalo State Asylum for the Insane, taken in May of 1965.
I mean, it's so beautiful.
It is
like
a beautiful building.
God. So sad that, you know, it was a place of such sadness
suffering.
And torture.
Yeah. This next one, cool photo of the main building while it operated as Hotel Henry, taken in 2017.
Wow.
I know, Gord. I feel bad for whoever dumped a lot of money into Hotel Henry, then to get hit by the pandemic. Oh, my God.
So many people across the nation.
Yep.
In so many different instances.
Mm-hmm. This is a fun night shot of the current Richardson Hotel, taken in the past few years.
Wow, still absolutely
it is
beautiful.
Gorgeous. Here's an unedited photo of a patient from the Buffalo State Asylum for the Insane being, quote, treated.
Oh my God.
She's in a straitjacket, not sure what device she's been sat down inside or why a basket seems to cover her head.
Oh boy.
That is terrible. This next one, another woman being treated with hydrotherapy. Based on the bandage around her head and her expression, I would expect she had recently been given a lobotomy.
Damn.
Crazy. And I will say that some of that wasn't intentional cruelty. They did not know.
Yeah.
Like some people were being torturous under the guise of therapy. Like, they actually thought this was going to help cure somebody, and it didn't. It just took somebody whose mind was already feeble, probably already scared and full of anxiety, and added like a crazy amount of, you know, just unnecessary pain to what they were already dealing with.
What, and fear?
Oh, man.
It's like that would make you act out in ways that you didn't even know you could.
Yep.
Well, that was a great story. I like that one.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't like the hazing part. I was like, Maxine, just fucking leave. But I get it. I get it. Like, there's, I don't know. I mean, even at my age, you know, it's like you still feel peer pressure to fit in, to belong, You're putting your book away. Are you done?
Oh my God. I was, like, it was the second story. I thought I was done there for a second.
I was looking down at my notebook. I'm like, did I miss something?
Just one story. You know what's funny about the peer pressure? And I honestly don't know where it comes from, but I've always had, like, I'm such a, what's the word? It's not
loner.
A little bit loner, but also like
weirdo, strange guy.
Somebody who, if everybody's going in one direction, I instinctively want to go the other direction.
Yeah,
it's there's a term for it, and I'm just blanking.
Contrarian, maybe?
Contrarian. Thank you, Logan. That's exactly it.
That's also the number one word we use to describe our daughter.
Oh yeah, I know, she's very much like me that way, and I don't know where it comes from.
I know,
but like peer pressure, I've always had an instinctive, very averse reaction where it's like, if you really want me to do something, just on principle, I won't do it.
I know this.
So like with like peer pressure, I never succumbed to it because when people just got too into it, it would just piss me off. And I'm like, you fucking do it. I'm like, why do you care if I don't do it? I'm like, I don't give a shit if you think it's cool or not.
Yeah.
I would just get mad.
But didn't you want to belong?
No.
I don't know if that's like boys, girls, if that's where you grew up. No, if that's just, you know, nature, nurture.
I think it might be a strong nature thing. It's like, I have had different like groups of friends over the years, and I do like friendships, and I'm working harder now later in life to like nurture those.
Yeah.
But I'm probably too comfortable being like a loner. Like, it is like a natural thing. Like, it doesn't usually bother me like it bothers some people.
Yeah, I would say definitely. I know it doesn't bother you, but I will also say that then conversely, you definitely have times of like, I want friends.
I know.
So yeah, exactly. There is something inside of you that, you know, like wants it.
Still a herd animal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's also like, you know, examples, you know, it's like your mom isn't super social. Mm-hmm. Your dad's not super social, like more social than your mom, your grandparents. I mean, living kind in a small town. Yeah. Like not in a bad way, but just whereas like my upbringing was all about community.
Yeah. So, we didn't have people popping in and out of the house that often. A few people, but like, no, it was never like a big social house growing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you have friends now.
Thank you. Well, you know, it's funny. It's like life. I had a lot of good friends in college. It was just so easy to have a social life there.
Yeah, of course.
And then everybody gets in their own little grooves.
Yep.
And then traveling for comedy for so many years, you know, just made it trickier.
Yeah.
And then with kids and everything. But you ready to leave Buffalo and head to Mexico?
I am. Take me somewhere warm.
Before we move on to more scares, we need to take a quick in-between story sponsor break. What is the most basic gift you have ever given the moms in your life for Mother's Day? Flowers? A candle? Some random knickknack you picked up at the last minute because you completely spaced Mother's Day?
I have definitely made the mistake of procrastinating gifts for Mother's Day, and then, like the Friday before, I run to whatever store is open and convince myself that, yes, my mom does need another coffee mug that declares she's the world's best. So lame.
This year, how about one upping yourself by giving the moms in your life an Aura picture frame? Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to any mom at any age. Aura frames connect easily to Wi-Fi and have unlimited storage so you can share as many pictures as you want.
This year, as many of you know, I am on a spending freeze, but one of my carve-outs was meaningful gifts for the people I love. I don't want to give all of the moms in our lives something that won't bring them joy. We are giving Aura frames to the moms in our world because they are timeless, heartwarming gifts.
Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off, plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code SCARED at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What are the things that weigh you down on a day-to-day basis? What kind of stress are you holding on to? Do you spend much of your day going over things in your brain over and over until they are so distracting it affects your mental health? Well, don't worry. You're not alone.
We all carry different stressors, some big, some small. When we keep things bottled up, the results can be negative. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest without fear or judgment. It's a place to work through what is heavy on your mind and heart so that you can feel lighter and happier.
I'm always holding on to something. It's the way my anxious brain works. I'm continually worried that I've done something wrong, that I've hurt the feelings of someone I love, and that I have let someone down. I'm stressed that I'm not being a good enough mom or wife. I panic that our life will implode at any given moment and it'll all be my fault. Thankfully, I have an amazing therapist who helps me talk through each of these scenarios. After each and every appointment, I feel lighter, happier, and more capable of showing up as my most authentic self.
Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/scaredtodeath today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/scaredtodeath.
Summer is just around the corner. Who's excited? I know I am. With the warmer, sunnier days calling your name, the last place you're going to want to be is in your kitchen, cooking and meal prepping. Make your life easier with Factor's no prep, no mess meals.
Factor's never frozen, always fresh meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Think of all the extra time you will get outside in the summer sun when you aren't wasting hours in the kitchen.
I think I speak for everyone when I say that the summer is the busiest time of the year. We are all trying to cram in as many things as possible, from concerts to vacations and everything in between. With Kyler home from college and Monroe on her break too, I want to spend as much time as possible with them. And while I truly love to cook, the summer is the one time of year that I'm the least interested in doing that for 3 meals a day. So I lean on Factor to help keep me healthy and in step with my diet. I'm obsessed with the honey yogurt pancakes for breakfast, the pork al pastor for lunch, and the cilantro lime barramundi for dinner. So easy and saves me so much time.
Head to factormeals.com/scaredtodeath50 and use code scaredtodeath50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code scaredtodeath50 at factormeals.com/scaredtodeath50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Thanks for listening to our sponsors, Creeps and Peepers. Excuse me. For this next story, we are headed to Mexico, like I said, specifically Guadalajara.
Let's go.
The capital of the state of Jalisco in western Mexico, Guadalajara is home to over 5 million people in its greater metropolitan area, making it the 20th largest metropolitan area in the Americas and third largest in Mexico. It's a center of business, arts and culture, tourism and technology, and home to historic locations like the Guadalajara Cathedral, numerous temples and theaters, and the San Juan de Dios Market, the largest indoor market in all of Latin America, 430,000 square feet.
Damn!
I know. Like many cities, if not all, it also has some darkness in its history, dating back to the earliest days of colonization. After originally being founded at three other sites, Spanish conquistadors eventually moved Guadalajara to its current location, once because of the Mixtone War in 1540, in which three groups of indigenous peoples fought back against the Spanish captives, captives and enslavers of natives. That's not the right word. Against the Spanish capture and enslavement of natives. That was the word written there, and it didn't feel right, and I was like, nope. Then I detoured, and no, it was right. The village of Guadalajara barely survived the war, and the villagers attributed their survival to the Archangel Michael, who remains patron of the city to this day. In the years that followed, several epidemics drastically reduced the city's indigenous population, leading to the construction of its first hospital in 1557. As history progressed, leaving more bodies in its wake, those bodies would pave the way for the construction of a large cemetery. The Santa Paula Cemetery was built to meet the need for more burial spots for victims of epidemics, primarily cholera in 1848. It was built on land that used to house the nearby hospital's orchards. The cemetery itself used to be divided into two parts, one nicer, more well-maintained section for the wealthy, and another section for the commoners. A class divide even in death. The section for the latter was closed down and the land returned to the hospital after the cemetery's closing in 1896. But the section for the wealthy has remained intact and open for viewing. Today you can visit, passing under a huge and impressive front entrance, carved into marble, like with little bones and skulls carved into the marble. Inside, walls of the interred rise up multiple stories, creating open-air rooms as you walk through. Bodies are buried in the ground only in the main section. These graves in the soil are the oldest, and they're generally the most notable people. Everyone else is in the walls. Due to crowding, most of the vaults have been used and reused numerous times and will be reused again in the future, typically by family members. After a certain number of years, the vault can be opened and the older body will be carefully and respectfully gathered and put into a bag. The bag will be placed inside the coffin of the more recently deceased person, and then that coffin will go into the vault and the gravestone will be updated. Unsurprisingly, the cemetery is shrouded in tales of ghosts roaming its grounds. Time now for the tale of a vampire and the boy who feared the dark. One of the most famous legends of the cemetery is that of Nachito. I actually really love this. Ignacio Torres Altamirano, better known as Nachito, was a little boy with a paralyzing fear of the dark. With the streets only illuminated by gas lamps, no electricity in Nachito's house, the boy was plunged into darkness each and every night, his only relief being a small candle that cast just enough of a glow to get him to fall asleep. His date of birth and exact age are unknown, but we do know the day he died, May 24th, 1882. On that night, there was a terrible storm. As Nachito lay huddled under some sheets, there was a bang, and the windows flew open, extinguishing all the candles in his room. Reportedly, when that happened, the anxious little boy, so afraid of the dark, died of shock. That would be unusual all on its own, but even stranger was what came next. The family buried him in the Santa Paula Cemetery, mourning a life lost far too early. And then the very next day, the graveyard's caretaker almost died of shock himself. He was making his customary rounds of the cemetery, cleaning up here and there, when he spotted a strange shape in the distance, exactly where the funeral had been only one day prior. Not a human shape, but the shape of an entire coffin. A coffin that had been dug up. What was happening? The man's mind immediately went to the boy's parents. Were they so deep in their grief that they went and dug their son's corpse up, unwilling to admit that their child had died? The caretaker didn't remember seeing anybody come in, and he had the only lock and key, but still, that was the only explanation. But it didn't explain how it happened again after he lowered the coffin back down into the ground and covered it over with dirt that night. And then it happened again, and again, and again. Night after night, the coffin would reappear, freshly unearthed as though it had struggled free from the underworld itself. It was only after 10 nights when Nachito's parents finally came forward with an explanation, a very paranormal explanation. Perhaps, they suggested, their son couldn't rest because of his fear of the dark. Maybe Nachito was driving himself out of the ground, consumed by terror, only to be put back into the ground and then repeat the same process the next night, and the next, and the next. According to this legend, they were so convinced that this was the truth that they decided to now build an open-air tomb, and inside it they placed a concrete coffin with slots where moonlight could enter. In addition, they put pillars on the four sides of the tomb, which supported burning torches lit every night. With these measures in place, Nachito's nighttime riots came to an end. Finally, the little one was resting in peace under the light of the moon and the stars and the warm glow of the torches. As the years went on, the story became enshrined into legend, and the people of Guadalajara began to leave toys and candy as offerings on his tomb. In more recent times, paranormal investigators often seek out his ghosts and have caught giggles, the question, "Do you want to play with me?" on EVPs, and the dark, childlike figure of a ghost has been seen running through the cemetery near his tomb at night. While the ghost of Nachito is probably the most famous spirit associated with the Santa Paula Cemetery, he's not the only one. Jose Castro was a 29-year-old doctor when he passed away June 9, 1861. He was adored by his patients, and after his death, many continued to visit his grave and ask for a consultation. According to legend, if you go to his tomb and pray exactly at midnight, you'll be healed of your disease. Over 150 years later, his tomb continues to be a hotspot for visitors, many of whom claim that their illnesses have mysteriously vanished afterwards. There are some more recent ghost sightings as well, ones nobody knows the origin stories behind. In 1996 and 2002, for example, the apparition of a monk was spotted in the cemetery. In the first instance, a couple was taking wedding pictures among the historic architecture. Once they received their photos back, they saw a monk in a brown robe holding a crucifix. But nobody remembered seeing that man that day. In 2002, someone was recording a funeral procession, saw the same figure again, wearing a brown robe, holding a crucifix. Despite being caught on tape, no one there remembered seeing him, though some did remember feeling a strange presence, a not entirely religious presence. Some wonder if this was a monk who changed sides and became a servant of the devil. Now he's cursed to wander the cemetery for the rest of time, looking for the god he abandoned. Our last ghost actually belonged to the hospital next door, but haunts the cemetery all the same. As one story goes, a sick young man found himself in the hospital struggling with a severe illness. He was losing hope and resented that his mother kept bringing up prayer and religion. If he only prayed, she told him, he might be cured. But after a few weeks, the doctors gave the young man horrible news. His illness was terminal. That night, while he slept, his mother left a picture of her favorite saint in his hand. When he woke up and saw the picture, he became enraged. He wanted nothing to do with God, with an entity that had clearly abandoned him, and he told his mother so, tearing up the picture. That night, his body was found hanging from a tree outside of his window, a tree in the cemetery. Suicide or something else? Today, only the stump of that tree remains, and it is said that at night, if you look at it, you can still see his shadow hanging from a phantom branch. When the hospital still had patients, those who stayed overnight, especially in the wing next to the cemetery, reported knocking coming from the windows facing the cemetery. This happened on all floors. But whenever they looked outside, nobody was ever there. They began to think it was the ghost of that young man, realizing he'd made a mistake when he left the hospital to do what he did, and now wanting to return inside to a time before he died. In the distance, on nights when this would happen, the branch of the tree he supposedly died on seemed to sway in the wind as though some heavy weight were attached to it. Other ghosts are also rumored to patrol the cemetery, but the details of their stories seem to have been lost to history. Finally, there is the legend of the vampire of Guadalajara. This legend begins in the mid-1800s. Citizens recounted an ongoing string of deaths occurring only at night, mostly happening at first to small animals like cats and dogs. The deaths always seemed to occur at night. Initially, it appeared that the deaths were from natural causes, but then as weeks wore on, the phenomenon persisted. An investigation ensued, and upon closer inspection, it was learned that the body of each animal corpse was marked by two closely positioned punctures. Furthermore, not a drop of blood remained inside their corpses. Shortly thereafter, the same tragedy began to happen to children, mostly newborns. Mothers would find their babies in their cribs, dead, similarly marked and drained of blood. And again, these deaths only occurred at night. Townsfolk were soon told to remain indoors after dark, but many didn't listen. And some adults began to show up dead in the same way, drained of blood, two closely positioned puncture wounds. Rumors of a vampire spread across the city. Finally, one night, a group of vigilantes ventured out to track down and eliminate this creature. Here is where the legend branches off into three separate stories. One storyline states that the mob rounded up suspects, singling out a ghostly-looking man, he being pale, white, and most resembling a vampire. They drove a stake through his heart to kill him. Another variation recounts the mob entering homes of individuals and locating another man, asleep in his bed, who they thought looked like a vampire, drove a stake through his heart and killed him. Both legends say that the body was then dragged to the Santa Paula Cemetery. The third rendition has the men setting up a trap and ensnaring a demonic beast. They then drag the beast's body to the Santa Paula Cemetery and, with a long stake, pierce its heart, leaving the monster to perish. The following morning, the corpse is covered with a thick concrete slab to trap it in place. Then, months later, the wooden stake that was used to kill the vampire that was left there began to grow, eventually becoming a large tree. Lore says that if one cuts the trunk of the tree, blood will seep out, the blood of the vampire buried below. Or that if a person breaks off one of the branches, not only will it gush blood, its leaves will impart a red residue on the skin. For nearly 200 years now, this tree has been growing. Its twisted vast network of roots undulate and wrap around adjacent graves and markers. According to the legends, the day will come when this gnarl will break the barrier slab covering the vampire, allowing him to escape and seek revenge on Guadalajara.
Oh no.
The tree stands today within the historic walls of the Santa Paula Cemetery, protected with a fenced enclosure to preserve its life. Whether or not this legend is true, the Santa Paula Cemetery sure seems like a fantastic place to go if you'd like to try and experience paranormal activity. Even if nothing happens, I'm sure at the very least, little Nachito will enjoy your company.
I want to go play with little Nachito.
I have some cool pictures.
Okay.
And actually, this first is a picture of Nachito's tomb at the Santa Paula Cemetery. And you can see a bunch of toy cars on the right, a bunch of candy, basketball, it looks like, various other toys just scattered around.
So sweet.
Mm-hmm. Just been for decades and decades. People have been leaving toys and candy there. This next picture is of the main entrance to the cemetery. It's beautiful.
Wow. Really beautiful.
And then one more picture. This is that supposed vampire tree fenced in.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to be around when it cracks and breaks open.
When it breaks that concrete slab.
Oh.
I know I love kind of more extreme kind of like folklore like that.
Yeah.
But then part of my brain does think like that would be, I mean, suck for whoever the vampire gets. But the paranormal lover in me would absolutely love it if it like finally breaks and something absolutely comes out of the ground.
It would be really, well, incredible.
Yeah, it'd be very incredible. Very, very good for those of us not close.
Right. we're fine over here.
Mm-hmm.
Idaho safe. Well, great stories, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing those tales with us today.
I'm excited to hear yours.
Oh my God, you're going to need a tissue. I'm probably going to cry.
Okay.
It's just so beautiful. You got your Layla?
I do. I got a little purple one today.
Oh, okay. Be nice to it.
Mm-hmm.
Pinky's out. Hello, king and queen of the spoops. My daughter turned me on to Scared to Death, and since then I've binged the whole library, became an Annabelle, and have now begun devouring Time Suck, which with breaks for new Scared to Deaths.
Thank you.
My daughter is definitely a creep. At 4 years old, she wore out 2 VHS tapes of Men in Black and knew every word to the entire movie. And since then, she has loved all things weird, creepy, and horror-filled. Creatures, gore, paranormal, all of it. Not me. I am most assuredly a peeper. I am fascinated with the paranormal and absolutely believe the spirit world exists and lives among us, and I love a good story. I'd like to share with you my favorite paranormal experience. Well, not mine directly, but one I will never forget. I am 50 years old. I have 2 daughters. My oldest is 30 and the youngest is 9.
Mm-hmm.
You read that right. There are 21 years between my 2 girls. 2 children only. I became a mom at 19 and then again at 41.
Mm-hmm.
In 2003, my mom passed away unexpectedly in her sleep early on Christmas Eve morning at the age of 55 when my oldest was 10. She beat brain cancer twice when I was 5 and 7 respectively. However, it took a very hard toll on her neurologically, so she declined in independence at a young age. She entered long-term care at age 42. My second daughter, Addie, was born in 2014. All of that to explain how my mom never got to meet Addie. In honor of Dan, time now for the tale of She Showed Me Where She Is. It was Christmas Eve morning, 2017. Addie, my husband, and I had all just gotten up and were around the kitchen island enjoying the morning, making breakfast, and chatting about getting to see Sissy, Addie's nickname for her older sister. We would be seeing her later that evening at our family's Christmas gathering. Out of the blue, Addie looks up from her milk and said, "Who passed?" Confused, my husband and I exchanged glances, and I said, "No one, sweetheart. Well, wait a minute." Looking at my husband, trying to orient myself to the date and the year and do the math, Addie was 4. No one close to her had passed yet in her short lifetime. I hadn't even made the connection yet that today was the anniversary of my mom's death until this very moment. It had hit me hard as my husband, who was still paused in the midst of scrambling eggs, just looked at me, I'm sure waiting to see how I was going to handle this. I turned to my daughter and said, "Actually, honey, my mom passed away. It was a long time ago, before you were born. In fact, it was Christmas Eve, just like today. 14 years ago today," I declared, finally getting through the math. Without missing a beat, she said, "I know, I saw her," as the sweet smile spread across her face. I froze. A chill began at the base of my skull and ran all the way down to the tips of my toes. My husband, who's generally stoic and can go with the flow, then put down the whisk and turned to lean on the counter to see what would come next, his eyes wide. My mind was racing. She saw her? How? Where? Here in our house? Recently? She's 4. I've never talked to her about my mom's passing. I knew we'd get around to talking to Addie about it, but we hadn't yet as she was still so young. I needed all these details, but had to be very careful not to show emotion or let her know I was rattled. And I certainly didn't want to scare her. I said, "When did you see her, honey? Where?" And in a matter-of-fact tone, she said, "Last night. She sat on my bed and petted my hair." I felt the tears welling up in my eyes. My mom was ill most of my childhood. I spent a lot of my time with my grandparents. My parents divorced, and eventually, my mom and I had moved in with my grandparents. But nothing was typical about my childhood because of her illness and the divorce. I had wished 1,000 times since her death that I could see her just one more time, like she was before the cancer, when she was smiling adoringly and full of life and vigor. I finally managed to say, "Well, did she talk to you?" Addie smiled and looked me right in the eyes and said, "No, but I could hear her thoughts, Mommy." I was beginning to tremble. Did this really happen? Had my mom paid her a visit? It made sense that she would visit her granddaughter. The only thing my mom ever wanted in the world was to have a daughter. I'm her only child, and I was her whole world. But she never got to fully be the mom she so badly wanted because of her illness. She had loved my oldest daughter so, so much during the time she had had with her. Of course, she would want to meet Addie. With the happiest look of joy on her face as she recalled their meeting, and before I could find the words to say, Addie simply said, "She showed me where she is, and it's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
My tears began overflowing and the perpetual chill was even stronger. I had to turn away as my husband stepped in and told her how wonderful it was that she'd gotten to meet her grandma in heaven. I wasn't scared or creeped out at all, but I couldn't help being jealous. I thought, seriously, Mom? You get a pass from heaven and you couldn't come get me first and we could go meet Addie together? Sat on her bed and petted her hair just like you used to do to me to get me to sleep? Wow, what in the actual? I didn't push Addie for any more details. I didn't want to scare her or rob her of this memory. But just like that, in true four-year-old fashion, she had moved on, babbling about Santa coming later that night and what presents she might get. To bring this full circle, fast forward to about 3 months later, I was doing some spring cleaning and going through closets and tubs of things. I came across several of my mom's photo albums. I was sitting in the middle of the living room floor with one open in front of me, and Addie was playing with her toys and watching Mickey Mouse Clubhouse a few feet away. Next thing I know, Addie walks over, squats down in front of me, and points to a picture in the album. It was a picture of my mom in Hawaii with her mom. "That's her," she said. "That's your mommy that petted my hair." Addie is 9 now. A couple of times, months, and even years later, I've asked her if she remembers seeing my mom in her dreams when she was little, but she doesn't. And that's okay. Everything I have thought to be true about good spirit visitors we share this world with was confirmed for me. I have wanted to see my mom so badly, but as a Mimi now myself, I understand the joy our grandbabies bring us and don't mind her trumping me for her granddaughter, Addie. Keep sucking spoops, Brandy.
Aw, thanks, Brandy.
Isn't that so sweet? Mm. I love this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. That's a really, really cool one.
Yeah, just so touching.
Just and, stroking her hair.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just like, yeah. I mean, that's like what you would hope for, right? If your mm-hmm. parents don't get to meet your children, mm-hmm. there's no better experience.
Yeah.
I mean, I think.
Yep. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great story.
Yeah. We haven't had one in a long time. Yeah. She did a great job of making mm-hmm. it all tie together and, you know, giving the background information.
Yeah.
Also like, wow.
Oh, the age range, that 19 and what was it, 41?
Sister. Like you really, her kids are 21 years apart. A 30-year-old and a 9-year-old.
Wow.
Like,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a lot of tenacity. Because mm-hmm. generally, once you're through it, you're like, I don't ever need to do that again.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love, if she was here, I'd be asking more, some questions.
Yeah. Like, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm. Like, did you want to, like, my mind, I mean, total speculation. But I'm like, well, you know, when you're 19, I mean, I just can't imagine if I would have had a kid at 19, how that would have changed my life.
Holy cow.
And how immature I was.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine
I mean, look how immature you are now.
A lot of people like grow up, you know, fast because of something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just, in my head, I was wondering, I'm like, well, I wonder if, you know, like you're so much more settled generally by the time you're in your 40s.
Yeah.
If she wanted to re-experience parenting from a different, like more settled place.
Yeah, probably.
Or maybe she, you know, just knocked it out of the park. It was like just a very mature 19-year-old the first time.
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? But good job, Brandy. Love that story.
Or is it whoopsie?
Whoopsie daisies. Okay. You ready for
the prison stories?
Spooky tale? Yes. I'm mm-hmm. very into this. So it's 4 small stories, 4 sightings told by one person. Thank you for taking the time to read my 4 tales. Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, Louisiana is the largest maximum security prison in the U.S. as far as land mass goes.
Dang.
18 acres of farmland on the Mississippi River. Prior to the Civil War, it was a slave plantation, and the majority of slaves came from the African nation of Angola, hence the name. Any way a man can die, it's happened on these grounds. Tale number 1. In June of 2000, I was a fresh cadet at the David C. Knapp Corrections Officer Training Academy, located on the grounds of the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, Louisiana. A month after high school graduation, and I'm training to start a career as a corrections officer. One night, I was driving down the road, heading back to the academy for nightly roll call. It was getting pretty dark as I was driving past a building that is the oldest standing cell block on the grounds. It's called Red Hat, so named because the roof has a red paint scheme and because inmates assigned to live there wore red bandanas on their hats to make them more visible while working in the fields. It was the harshest block to live in, and it also housed the death chamber. As I was driving by, I saw inmates working in the fields around the building. I thought it was odd as hell to see inmates at night and no officers on horseback watching them, especially in the dark. Then I thought, maybe it was a training exercise or roving security, but there were no vehicles or flashlights at all. I drove onto the academy and was scratching my head when I saw my master sergeant. I asked him, "Hey, Sarge, Do inmates work the fields at night as extra duty or something? He looked at me like I was dumber than rocks. I told him what I had seen, and his expression changed from annoyance to something like guarded. Cadet, you saw nothing of the sort and won't say another word. But to answer your question, there are no living inmates in the fields of Angola at night. Now drop it and get ready for roll call. Turns out, everyone on the farm knows it's haunted, but no one talks about it because of backroom politics, and they don't want to appear crazy and potential security breaches from ghost hunters wanting to sneak in and capture a Casper. Tale 2, July 2000. I was working a dormitory in Camp D at Angola, Falcon 3, 68 inmates per one officer. I was locked in for the night doing my shift. It was about 3 a.m. and I was doing the ball watch. Prison slang, military slang for falling asleep in my chair and looking at my crotch. Yep, just watching my balls, not even sleeping. However, something caused me to look up at the front door. The front door from my security desk was about 50-ish feet. I saw a free man, aka a corrections officer, standing at the door. This officer was tall, white, skinny, kind of young looking. He had gold on his collar, so I knew he was a rank of some sort, either a captain or a lieutenant. He knife hand pointed at me and did his fingers like a come here gesture. I got up, walked around my desk, a long wooden desk about 15 feet in an L shape. I looked back at the front door. No one was there. A funny thing about those front doors, they're big, heavy steel doors. The key sergeant jingles his keys loudly and opens and closes the door loudly to let you know it's opening. It's standard operating procedure to do it, but I didn't hear a single noise. As I walked to the front door, I was thinking the free man was taking deep breaths to calm himself because he was about to blow my doors open for sleeping on the job. I walked up to the TV/front room, and there was no free man there. Just two inmates watching TV wearing standard inmate uniforms of white shirts and blue jeans. I asked if they saw anyone, and one said, "Sarge, whatever you're smoking, I wish you'd share." And I just snorted and said, "If it's making me see shit, I'd give it to you because I don't want it no more." I turned to make a round to get fully awake, and my captain came in to make his round as well. A tall black guy with glasses, so it wasn't him popping in, then back out to screw with me. He made his rounds and left. I didn't think anything of it for about a year until I was talking to some coworkers, and they asked me to describe who I saw. They said it was Captain David Knapp, who was killed in December of 99 on the Falcon side by the hobby shop by four inmates in an escape attempt.
Damn.
I didn't believe it at first, but when I saw a picture of Captain Nat, I'll kiss your tail if that ain't who I saw. Tale 3. Same camp and dorm, different year. It was 3 a.m. and I was doing the ball watch again. I had that same feeling to look up at the front door. I saw a tall, bald black man with a limp in his right leg walk around the corner from the TV room to the game room. Any inmate coming in after lights out went straight to the desk to get patted down. I got up to go blow his doors down. But when I made it to the game room, not a soul was there. I started walking around the dorm, and only one inmate was awake. A short guy named Nick, who we called Bravo because he was 11 Bravo before he got locked up. He was sitting on the floor, shining his boots, and looked up at me as I passed by. He said, "You look like you saw a ghost, Sarge." I distorted, "Nah, just seeing shit." He asked me to describe who I saw, and after I did, he said, "Oh, that's Hightower. Died here 2 years ago from AIDS. I see him every night." Just so nonchalantly, like he was saying he saw a bird or a cloud.
Jeez.
Tale 4. This one gives me the willies to this day. Same dorm, 2004, 3 a.m., ball watching. This time, I get the feeling to look up at the water fountain between the game room and the bathroom. I saw what I can only describe as a shadow man. Just a solid shadow and bright white eyes. He was sitting on the floor with his back to the wall and resting his arms on his knees. We locked eyes, and he went from sitting on his butt to standing up in a smooth and fluid motion that I'd never seen a man do in my life. He kinda rolled his shoulders and forced his chest out, flexing at me. I shook my head and blinked my eyes. The figure was gone instantly. I got up and went over for a closer look at the spot, but nothing was there. From what a friend of mine said, she was big on the paranormal and other related things, I saw a shade, a kind of manifestation of energy that is seldom seen, but they tend to flex when they are seen because they are just as surprised to be seen as you are to see them. And those are my four tales. I hope you all enjoy them. You all have a good one now, and keep on sucking. John.
Thanks, John.
I love the way John is so Southern, the way that he wrote, have a gooden, a gooden, a good one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. G-O-O-D-U-N. Yeah. Gooden.
Mm-hmm. Have a gooden.
I was like, oh my God, I love it. Yep. I love that you write the way you speak.
I was trying to think like what would be scarier. It was like tail two, I think, and then definitely four. But that Captain Nat, the
Nap.
Nap with a P? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. It's funny. I wrote that first, then crossed it out and wrote. I was like, nah, sorry. No one's named Nap.
K-N-A-P-P. Ah. Nap.
Okay, so this Captain
Knapp.
Knapp. This free man ghost. But like that experience, I mean, clearly he looked real enough where he thought it was like a regular person.
Yeah, he's like, I'm about to get in so much trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Like you're just seeing a person. That is so trippy to think about that being a ghost that appears like, you know, not like transparent.
Right.
Not shadowy.
Three-dimensional.
Three-dimensional.
Like, seems alive.
Mm-hmm, seems like you could touch him, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And I was like, what would be scarier, seeing that or then seeing that shadow figure with the white eyes puffing his chest out, like the humanoid shape?
I know.
They're so very different experiences. And it's just crazy that he had both of them at this prison.
Or is the scariest thing being one officer to 68 fucking inmates?
That's the scariest.
When I read that, I was
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Terrifying.
Also, I did think this is the beginning of the story, but like this, so this prison is named Angola, right?
Yeah, he says that it is called...
Yeah, A-N-G-O-L-A.
Yeah, am I saying it incorrectly?
No.
Okay, Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, Louisiana.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, I guess like they're saying that they're referencing where it's from. I thought, because I was like, that is so messed up. I thought they named the prison like Angola.
Oh.
Because that's the country from Africa where most slaves came from. I'm like, that's so fucked up.
Well, he says in the beginning, he says prior to the Civil War.
The town is named there.
It was
named that.
Well, the largest maximum security prison.
If the prison is named that, that's pretty messed up. That's not like an honor to like name a prison after another country. And then if you have a history of a bunch of slaves being from that country, that's like, it seems like a more insult.
I'm going to say that the area or like town or city
I think so.
Angola, because also just thinking about, well, I don't know.
I bet it's that.
I guess I don't know how old the buildings are there. So that's mm-hmm. where I was trying to, that's what I'm trying to reconcile is like, if there are buildings as old as, I don't know.
Yeah.
The prison system is so fucked that it's like, I actually wouldn't be that surprised. And like and Louisiana, so wouldn't be surprised there.
I know. I feel bad for COs, like the guards
mm-hmm.
and the prisoners. It's bad for the guards where they're generally not paid much,
mm-hmm.
And it's an incredibly dangerous job in many mm-hmm. prisons because of like the ratio,
uh-huh.
the prisoner to guard ratio.
Sure,
that is like not good. So right. dangerous. And then, you know, we could spend a long time talking about how many nonviolent offenders are put in there and along racial lines, all kinds of bad stuff.
Yep. Yeah. And somewhere in Louisiana, I don't think it's at this because this sounds like, I think, maximum security, but is like some of the harshest prison conditions.
Mm.
And there was recently, and I don't think that this is news to anybody. I think this was fairly commonly known. I mean, I was aware of this to some degree, but there was a, like a juvie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, a juvie detention center and something happened there. And so then they shipped all these kids to like this like terrible fucking prison, like
Damn.
Even worse conditions. There are such horrific prison conditions across the country.
Yeah.
But specifically Louisiana and Mississippi.
The worst.
Just like you could do a 5-hour time suck and still...
I have heard that about Louisiana actually. Yeah, I didn't know. That's crazy.
The state governor, like fucking Jeff Landry, he is... Wild, like that governor is wild right now. Like he just passed a law
mm-hmm.
that you can just have a concealed carry with no fucking training and no fucking permit. Here you go, carry it wherever the fuck you want.
Yeah.
I'm like that is insane. In the city that also has open container laws. So we think it's a good idea to let folks roam around the streets of, let's just say, New Orleans mm-hmm. with open containers and guns.
Let's go Wild West again.
Like what the frickety frackety?
We're just trying to get back to the Wild West.
Can I mention something on the prison real quick?
Yeah.
I did look it up and it's according to its Wikipedia, it says it is named Angola after the former slave plantation that occupied this territory.
The fuck?
That is so messed up. Yeah, that's crazy.
It's like, you were slaves then and you are slaves now.
Oof. Yeah. Yeah.
And also it does look like the town is also called Angola. I'm sure probably for the same reason.
Right, right.
My blood is boiling, literally boiling.
Literally? You're
yep. Good. I am on fire. I am going to spit out fire. I am on fire. I'm cooking from the inside
out. Call 911. She's literally boiling.
I love using literally wrong, intentionally, because it's just so great. So great. The visuals.
But I was when I was younger, I used to think about how would I handle myself in prison? Would I be Andy Dufresne from Shawshank?
Oh God!
Or go Bronson, this crazy movie about Britain's notorious, where he just kept fighting and just nobody messed him up. I would like to think I could be Bronson, if I knew I was going to have to just be in prison forever. Mm-hmm. But I think I'd probably be Andy Dufresne.
You and I have talked about this. Could you go to prison? Could you survive it? I don't think that I could.
I don't think you'd do well.
I don't think so. I'm not a hard bitch, you know?
I'd have to go full evil to survive.
Well, the way you look, you could just join the Aryan Nation and survive.
Sadly, it's I have read a lot of stories about people, when they get into, long-term prisons, mm-hmm. hardcore prisons. It's I used to think when I was younger, oh, that's so fucked up. You're just some skinhead. And then you read these stories, no, I wasn't racist. It was that or die.
Yeah.
It was that was the only gang that would take me. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have protection from them, the other gang members were going to kill me.
Yeah. I know.
But now I hear some prisons, it's not as bad as it used to be. I don't know.
I don't know. But I just don't think that I'm cut out for it. And it was recently on my mind because what was that movie where the girl, on the set, Rust. That movie mm-hmm. with,
and Alec Baldwin, the
whole thing.
There.
And it's I've been following that more closely than I need to be. I'm so fascinated from the production standpoint. I dated a gun handler. I worked in props departments. It's just so upsetting on so many levels.
Yeah.
And she's going to prison for a couple years for involuntary manslaughter. Crazy. She's a young woman. She's had a hard life as it was. And I just was thinking could I handle that?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I really don't know. I think that there's a high probability of suicide for me in that situation. I just don't think I'm cut out for it.
Well, hopefully we never have to find out.
Oh, let's never find out. Drive safely. Don't text and drive. Seriously, I think about things like that. Because it's that's how people who are not built for that shit mm-hmm. end up in places like that. Because I didn't go out seeking trouble.
Yeah.
Blah.
Ay, ay, ay.
Ichi, wawa.
Do you want to thank Annabelle's first or me?
I will. I'll let you think of how you're going to nicely say names clearly and effectively.
I'm not
going
to do it in another language. I'm too hungry.
And no, I was hoping you were just going to be proper with your finishing school touches.
Okay.
Okay. thank you for supporting us on Patreon. We'll announce this month's charity in a few weeks. Shannon Gibson, Kate Shook, Barbara Duvall, Mackenzie I, Vatra, Vatra, Brenna Glazer, Dick McButts, Dylan Montoya, and Carl Thrasher. Carl, you have a fucking awesome name.
Mr. Thrasher. Thrasher.
Well, 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 look who it is. Mr. Thrasher.
I would love it if, I mean, no, it's not, but I would love it if somehow Dick McButts is a real name.
Oh, that'd be so great.
And you're actually named Richard McButts, but you choose to go by Dick McButts.
I mean, if your name is Richard McButts, I think, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I would like to thank the following Annabelles: Karen Fancher, Josh Deutscher. I want to say.
I was why are you laughing?
Because I was is it actually pronounced Deutscher? It's Deutsch. I think D E U T S H.
Deutscher.
Yeah, Deutscher. He's been called Mr. Deutscher, for sure.
Sure.
That's come up. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Just you've been called Mr. Come In.
Mr. Come.
Like, okay.
Big Papa B.
Woo!
Scary Carrie. Cassandra Kaiser. Ben Mitchell. Ice Pick. That sounds like a gang member in prison.
No shit.
What's up, Ice Pick? Josh.
He'll keep you safe.
yeah.
Do you join his gang?
Get on the good side of Ice Pick.
Yeah.
Elise and John McD. And Annalise Kaler.
Nice. Spoopy shout outs. You're excused. To Michael from Lissa, happy birthday. To Lily Rain from your mom, Bridget, happy birthday. To my little Spitfire, I love you, sweet pea. To Smith from Smith, happy birthday. And to Andrew from Jesse, let's win big in Vegas. I love you to infinity and beyond.
Aww, a little, Toy Story reference there.
Well done.
Infinity and beyond. That is our show. Thanks for continuing to send in your personal tales of terror to mystory@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. You can email us for everything else at info@scaredtodeathpodcast.com. Thank you to Logan Keith for... I somehow wrote it differently. When I brought it over from another ending, notes. And I wrote, thanks to Logan and Keith. Big shout out to Logan and also to Keith.
The thing is mm-hmm. that for as long as we've been working with Logan, people will frequently be I emailed Keith. Mm-hmm. And then for a long time last year when we were working on summer camp, Tyler was Logan and Logan was Tyler. And I finally mm-hmm. had to say the very obvious thing. I was like, hey guys, the black guy is Tyler and the white guy is Logan.
Not just once too.
It was several times. Yeah. They could not get it.
So funny. No, it's been my whole life though. It's so funny because I have three first names.
Yeah, what's your middle name?
Ray.
Ray.
Yeah, that's right. Yep, all first names. So thanks to Logan for editing, publishing today's show.
That guy, the white one.
Thanks to Heather Rylander for organizing the My Story emails, to book editor Drew Atana, polishing and preparing listener stories for book number 5. Thank you to producer Molly Jean Box, finding the first story I told this week. Sophie Evans for finding the second. We are on YouTube if you want to watch the show, and we're on Facebook and Instagram where we post pics that accompany episodes and more at Scared to Death Podcast. We also have a private Facebook group, Creeps and Peepers, full of fellow horror lovers. Big thanks to the all-seeing eyes, the Creeps and Peepers moderators for keeping that place fun. And big thanks to the new Patreon subscribers who have signed up recently. Yeah, to get early release, ad-free episodes, bonus episodes, and more. We are so grateful for the new support and also continually grateful for the support from longtime Roberts and Annabelles.
You keep this train on the tracks.
Mm-hmm. Enjoy your nightmares, Creeps and Peepers. Hope you were scared to death.
Bye.
If spirits threaten me in this place, fight water by water and fire by fire. Banish their souls into nothingness and remove their powers until the last trace. Let these evil beings flee through time and space. Evil may pass through, but have no home here within, scared to death.
Mad Magic Productions.
You fucking do it. I don't give a shit if you think it's cool or not.